Welcome back. In the previous lecture, we looked at Greek and Roman law and legal process. We discovered that the principle of equality before the law was not fully upheld because of the inherent inequalities in both societies. In today's lecture, we're going to be investigating what the Greeks and the Romans thought about the others. And by the others, I mean foreigners, slaves, women, all of whom were debarred from full participation in the life of the community. So too, to some degree, were the disabled, simply by virtue of their incapacitation. All, therefore, in their various ways, were treated as less than fully human, the subject of this lecture. To put it in context, however, we need to note that this devaluation of certain others was by no means unique to the Greeks and the Romans. On the contrary, it was true of every Mediterranean society for which we have any evidence. Every known society in that time, that period, practiced some form of slavery, for instance. And it goes without saying that there was no recognition of what we would call today human rights anywhere in the ancient Mediterranean. Until the advent of Christianity, there was no sense either that all human beings are equal in the sight of God, or indeed the gods. Even so, there were important differences in attitude between the Greeks and the Romans, and it is those differences that we're going to try to explore as well. In both societies, slaves were only marginally regarded as human. They had no political rights, and they were not permitted to represent themselves in a court of law. In both societies, being a slave was, well, unfortunate. Merely the luck of the draw, you might say. Although the great philosopher Aristotle did famously make a distinction in the Politics between what he called natural slavery, slaves who were born into slavery, and legal slavery, free-born individuals who were reduced to servile status largely through the accident of war. The philosopher Bernard Williams wrote, "The standard Greek attitude to slavery was not that it was a just institution, nor again that it was an unjust institution. Their view rather was that the institution was necessary, and that for those subjected to it, it was bad luck. In that sense, it lay outside the considerations of justice." And that would have been equally true of the Roman world as well. A slave was completely at the beck and call of his or her master or mistress, and that master or mistress had the right to use or abuse his or her slave in any way he or she saw fit, even if use or abuse resulted in death. Both in Greek and in Roman law, the testimony of a slave was only acceptable in a court of law if given under torture, as we saw before. And both societies used slaves in pretty much every branch of activity, domestic, agricultural, industrial. In neither was slavery a single, universal, all-encompassing condition or status. Rather, it was a status or condition that varied considerably according to such factors as qualifications and general trustworthiness of the slave concerned, and the generosity and humanity of the owner. Yet given the prevalence of hardship, poverty, and disease in the ancient world, for some it was actually preferable to be a slave than to be a freedman. And when Odysseus encounters Achilles in the underworld in Book 11 of the Odyssey, Achilles makes the remark that he would rather be a man who works for another man than lord of all the dead. He doesn't say he'd rather be a slave, because that would actually be better than being a day labourer. A, because it was a disgrace for a free man to work for another, and B, because he'd have no security, which a slave did have, of sorts at least. And in some cases, very close ties of mutual respect did develop between a master or mistress and a slave. Particularly close ties developed between those who nursed children and their charges in later life. Sticking with the Odyssey, think of the relationship between Odysseus and his nurse Eurycleia. It's Eurycleia who notices the scar on Odysseus's thigh when he returns to Ithaca disguised as a beggar, the point being that Eurycleia is intimate with his personal history. In fact, the Odyssey makes a point of differentiating the slaves who have been loyal to Odysseus throughout his 20 years of absence and those who have been not loyal. And it's clear that those who have been loyal are, despite their status, very much regarded as human. Moving to the Roman world, the Roman orator and politician Cicero paid this fulsome tribute to his Greek slave and amanuensis, Tiro. He writes, "Your services to me are innumerable, both in the home and when I'm outside, in both my private and public affairs, in my studies and in my literary endeavours." Incidentally, Tyro is said to have invented a system of shorthand so that he could take down at speed his master's voluminous thoughts. Cicero and Tyro may have been unusual, but they are unlikely to have been unique. In many situations in the ancient world, those who were free depended very heavily on the goodwill, integrity, competence, etc. of their slaves and would have treated them as near equals. Even so, I don't want to give the impression that slavery was a benign institution. Far from it. The Emperor Augustus, for instance, who gets high marks for his political enlightenment, once had the legs of a slave who annoyed him broken. And likewise, Hadrian, another good emperor, stabbed one of his slaves in the eye, again in a fit of rage. And these are instances involving domestic slaves who would have been the best treated of all. Those who worked in the country on big estates or worse down in the mines were immeasurably more badly treated. Most of them were simply worked to death. And very rarely, however, oddly, one might say, do we hear of slave revolts. But that was because it was so difficult for slaves to unite. The most famous slave revolt occurred in 73 BC when a Thracian called Spartacus broke out of a gladiator school in Capua and managed to raise an army of some 90,000. Spartacus has become the stuff of legend and of celluloid, though whether he was the dashing, heroic social revolutionary played by Kirk Douglas in Stanley Kubrick's movie is dubious at best. Though he defeated the Romans in several battles, he was eventually driven down into the heel of Italy and defeated. Marcus Licinius Crassus, the general who eventually defeated him, crucified the captured slaves, some 6,000 of them, all along the Appian Way. Sadly, there's no evidence for the most famous line in Kubrick's film when Crassus demands of the captured slaves, "Who is Spartacus?" Each of the cast of thousands playing the slaves gets up and says, "I am Spartacus." We cannot offer even a ballpark figure as to the size of the servile population in either Greece or Rome. In the Greek world, it probably remained fairly static in the classical period. But when the Romans conquered the Greek world, it must have dwindled considerably as the Greeks themselves became enslaved. In fact, the first great influx of slaves into Rome occurred after the defeat of the Macedonians in 168 BC at the hands of the Romans. Captives and refugees now flooded the Roman slave markets, and the vast majority of them were Greek. And another large influx occurred in 146 BC following the destruction of Carthage, and another after the wars fought against Mithridates in the 80s BC. Yet another as a result of Julius Caesar's campaigns in Gaul in the 50s BC, and then the great influxes came to an end. It's clear that of all the slaves that were available to them, the Romans prized most highly those of Greek ethnicity. Many of them, moreover, secured positions of considerable influence in the Roman household, particularly true in the imperial household. Almost all of Augustus's slaves, whom his biographer Suetonius mentions by name, were Greek. And it was Greeks primarily who manned the professions, notably as physicians, teachers, and so forth. One of the major differences between Greece and Rome is that in Rome, the head of the family, the paterfamilias, had the right to execute a slave. In Athens, by contrast, and probably in most parts of the Greek-speaking world, a slave owner was not entitled to put a slave to death, although he was free to inflict injury. One exception to this rule is Sparta, where the servile population, known as helots, were routinely abused and often killed. The reason for this was that the helots who came from Messenia, the territory that lay to the west of Sparta, were a people and as such presented a constant threat to their masters. An Athenian aristocrat named Critias, one of the 30 tyrants who ruled Athens at the end of the Peloponnesian War, aptly observed that in Sparta, the free were the most free and the slaves the most enslaved in all of Greece. The helots, by the way, were the only Greek slaves who staged a successful revolt against their masters, which they did in 370 to 369 BC. And it was successful because, in large part, Helots shared the same ethnicity, the same customs, the same beliefs, and so on. So they could unite. And they even went so far as to establish a new polis in Messene itself, or re-established it, as they themselves claimed. Another major difference between the Greeks and the Romans is that among the Romans, neither slavery nor freedom was a fixed and immutable state of being. In fact, a great number of people passed from slavery to freedom, and probably as many from freedom to slavery. It was, for instance, commonplace for slaves to be freed on the death of their master or mistress, and clearly this was an incentive for good behaviour. In addition, Roman slaves earned a modest income known as peculium, roughly 5% of the work they put in, with which they might eventually buy their freedom. The Romans calculated that it would take a hard-working slave about 7 years to earn enough money to do this, which was another incentive to good behaviour, making the institution not unlike in more recent times indentured servitude. In fact, many freedmen, as they were called, were able to integrate themselves quite successfully into Roman society. The Romans might seem to have been more enlightened than the Greeks, but again, the real reason for the difference had more to do with pragmatism and with the inherent pluralism of Roman society than it did with any particular sympathy for the plight of the slave. The process of freeing a slave was known as manumission, which means literally sending away with the hand, and it really has no Greek equivalent. What we hear much less about is of free individuals becoming enslaved as a result of falling into debt, but it probably happened quite prevalently. Freedmen constituted a sizable percentage of the Roman population and were able to advance themselves economically, although they did not become full citizens. They weren't able to hold high office or to become senators. And among the most powerful in their ranks were Pallas and Narcissus, who enjoyed the confidence of the Emperor Claudius, ruled from 41 to 54 AD, and who were given the right to marry, actually, citizen women. They were also fabulously wealthy, in fact, as kings and potentates. The writer Pliny the Elder says that they both were wealthier than Marcus Licinius Crassus, who owned estates worth 200 million sesterces. Another wealthy ex-slave was Gaius Caecilius Isidorus, who in his will, dated 8 BC, left behind 60 million sesterces in coins alone, and he also owned over 4,000 slaves. These were billionaires by our terms. Sociologists call this phenomenon status dissonance, meaning that certain individuals were able to break through the constraints of the social and economic hierarchy. And this kind of mobility did not happen in Greece. It demonstrates how much play there was in Roman society, in the imperial period at least, for those who were A, very fortunate, and B, very talented. And it's worth noting as well that all three that I've mentioned, Pallas, Narcissus, Isidorus, were Greek. Let's turn next to the status and condition of women. This, of course, is a huge subject of investigation and one that we could discuss endlessly. It's also a highly complex and much contested subject. Let me just say as an aside that there is a feeling in some quarters that classics and ancient history are the preserve of male chauvinist pigs. Absolutely not. Feminist theory was introduced into the study of the ancient world in 1973 when a special issue of one of the trade journals was devoted to the subject. Perhaps its principal contribution is its emphasis upon the fact that almost all the information that we have about women in antiquity has been handed down by male sources. And this insight, which now seems obvious, has necessitated a complete re-examination, not only of the position of women in the classical world, but of the very concept of woman, by which I mean what it actually meant to be a woman. Both the Greeks and the Romans were deeply sexist by our standards, and there's no getting away from that fact. And I don't think many scholars today would try to defend them against that charge. For a start, neither society offered any real outlet for female talent. Pericles, in the great funeral speech that he delivered over the dead in the first year of the Peloponnesian War, famously observed, "The highest glory for a woman is to be spoken of neither in praise nor in blame." In other words, women should be socially invisible. And the same thinking prevailed in Roman society. Women who achieved high visibility were often accused of loose morals, as in the case of Sempronia, who in the 60s BC formed an association with a dangerous social revolutionary called Catiline. According to the conservative historian Sallust, Sempronia was, I quote, so consumed with lust that she more often made advances to men than they did to her. Though, he also portrays her as attractive, intelligent, witty, an excellent conversationalist, and an accomplished poetess. In addition, women in both societies were strictly controlled, and for that reason, I don't think very many people living in the West today would have wanted to be either a Greek woman or a Roman woman, though if you had a choice, I think it would have been marginally preferable to be a Roman. There were in both societies a few women who led moderately free and unrestricted lives, but what they did was limited. They included women in showbiz, singers, dancers, actresses, also prostitutes, and a small number of highborn women. But even someone like Livia, the wife of Augustus, the emperor, was constrained in ways that a Western woman today would find intolerable, in that she had virtually no public role whatsoever. True, she was the first lady of sorts, but she would rarely have appeared beside her husband before the Roman people, except at gladiatorial contests at which all members of the imperial family were expected to show their faces. And as with slaves, we have practically no personal testimony from any woman, either Greek or Roman. In addition, mostly what we know about their lifestyle is related to the well-to-do. We know very little about the lives of the poor classes and the lower ones. One of the important differences between Greece and Rome is that Roman matronae, that is, married women, participated in social and convivial gatherings, whereas in Greece, in Athens at least, which is a society that we know most about, freeborn women were excluded from such gatherings. Their place, incidentally, was taken by hetairai. The word means female companions, not exclusively prostitutes, though some of them did offer sexual favours, but in some cases quite educated women, foreign-born for the most, who could hold their own in discourse with men. One of the main reasons for the difference is that in Rome, men were absent for extended periods on military campaigns, which meant that women had a more important social role, whereas in the Greek world, service was generally limited to a single campaigning season. Roman women also enjoyed a higher degree of financial independence for the same reason. We know of very few women who were creative artists or intellectuals, though we do hear of a number of Greek poetesses, Sappho, Corinna, Erina, and Anite. However, none of their work has survived except in fragments, and that in itself seems to tell us something about ancient prejudices. On the Roman side, we know of just one poetess, Sulpicia. As luck would have it, her work was wrongly attributed to the elegiac poet Tibullus, which perhaps suggests that nobody could quite believe a woman capable of writing verse. The most famous woman intellectual was a Greek mathematician called Hypatia of Alexandria, dates AD 370 to 415. Not surprisingly, Hypatia was credited with great beauty. It was as if no one could believe that a woman was capable of achieving intellectual eminence by brains alone. We don't hear of any female prose writers in either society, and in neither society did women have any direct political influence, though members of the Roman imperial family exercised a great deal of indirect influence, we may suspect. Despite the achievements and relatively high visibility of a handful of female intellectuals and artists, there's no getting away from the fact that in both Greece and Rome, women were largely regarded as biologically and intellectually inferior to men. Aristotle, in a treatise called Generation of Animals, notoriously defined a woman as an infertile male. She is female, he went on to say, because of a kind of inadequacy, adunamia, being unable to produce semen. That's because menstrual discharge was regarded as an inferior or failed type of semen. And Roman law codes refer regularly to the infirmitas sexus, the weakness of the sex, and their levitas animi, their feeble mental powers. But again, deplorable though these attitudes are, we shouldn't pride ourselves too much on the emancipated outlook of the modern era. It wasn't until 1920 that the 19th Amendment was passed in this country, giving women the right to vote. And it wasn't until 1947 that Cambridge University accorded women undergraduates the same status as men. And it wasn't until 1984 that Liechtenstein, the smallest country in Europe, finally allowed women to vote on national issues. And let me quote a distinguished English writer on the subject of women's suffrage. "Voting ought to mean arguing for hours and hours in a public house, interrupting people and hitting the table. It ought to mean elbowing in great crowds and roaring and singing and rising in rebellion and killing men over barricades. In short, voting, if it means anything, means all the things that males have always done, notably fighting and drinking and talking about everything and nothing." That's G.K. Chesterton, best known as the author of the Father Brown short stories, writing at the beginning of the 20th century, which just shows us how long-lived certain prejudices are. Another severely disadvantaged group was the disabled and the congenitally deformed. Few infants who were deformed would have survived infancy. That's because the Greeks and the Romans would have had little compunction about withholding the necessities of life from those they deemed incapable of fending for themselves. In Sparta, the abandonment or exposure of a deformed infant was required by law, and a similar situation seems to have prevailed in Rome. Even those with minor oddities would have been regarded as second-class citizens in classical antiquity. No one with a club foot or a squint or a birthmark, for instance, would have been permitted to hold a priesthood. The reasons for this were complicated, but they had much to do with the fact that such a person would have been regarded as disfavored by the gods. And yet, practically everyone who survived to middle years in the ancient world would have manifested one disability or another. Deteriorating eyesight, for instance, was just one of the inevitable consequences of advancing years, for which the ancient world had no provision. We tend to overlook the fact that the populations of antiquity contained a vast number of individuals who in this and other ways were severely handicapped, and these too were the marginalized. Finally, let's talk about foreigners. As we've already seen, the Romans looked down their noses at Greeks, and the Greeks looked down their noses at Romans. In terms of racism, there wasn't a lot to choose between them. There were certainly exceptions, particularly among members of the elite, and the situation was by no means entirely constant throughout antiquity. But broadly speaking, there was a latent racial tension underpinning their relationship at all times. If anything, the Greeks were more racist than the Romans, partly perhaps because they didn't have to deal with other peoples on a daily basis as the Romans did. In fact, the Romans would not have become top nation in the Mediterranean if they hadn't shown a disposition to tolerate, deal with, and to some extent respect other peoples. Of course, a lot of them manifested prejudice against foreigners on a personal level, but that's true of any society, our own included, where laws are in place to protect minorities. The Greeks, by contrast, never faced a challenge of this magnitude, that is to say, of having to integrate non-Greeks into their society. The Spartans, for instance, were flagrantly xenophobic and admitted virtually no one. The Athenians were much more tolerant of foreigners, partly because they benefited from their presence in the community as traders. At the top end of society, again, things were probably different. As we see from the Odyssey, when Odysseus' son Telemachus goes off in search of news of his father, he's courteously received by men of social rank, since ties of mutual hospitality, known as xenia, exist between them. A whole system was in place to foster contacts abroad of this sort between aristocrats, but this was the exception, and it was not extended to men of lesser rank. On the few occasions when the Greeks did come into close contact with other peoples on a large scale, there was often serious trouble. Just one example of Greek close-mindedness and prejudice towards foreigners. In AD 38, in the city of Alexandria in Egypt, racially motivated riots broke out between the Greeks and the Jews, resulting in the first serious pogrom, or massacre of the Jews, of Roman times. Subsequently, the Greeks forced the Jews to live in an exclusively Jewish part of the city, located in the Delta area, and in so doing created the first compulsory ghetto in the Mediterranean. I'll be talking about that later. The Romans, by contrast, were in the business of integrating the different populations and ethnic groups. Finally, in AD 212, the Emperor Caracalla passed an edict declaring that every free male living within the borders of the empire was now a Roman citizen. But before we become too Jewy-eyed about the Romans, we need to note that by this point in history, Roman citizenship had ceased to carry any very important privileges, or even to mean anything very much. In fact, they'd been giving out citizenship right, left and centre long before that, first to the Latins, the people who lived in their immediate neighbourhood, then to the peoples of Italy, then to privileged groups like physicians, whom they wanted to settle within their borders, then to legionaries on their discharge from military service, then to members of the provincial elite, etc., etc. The Romans did so in response to political, economic, social and military pressures. It was in their best interests, in other words, to look favourably on foreigners. Even so, they still deserve considerable credit for the fact that they had the vision to be inclusive. No human society had ever taken this step before. Alexander the Great's so-called policy of fusion, which some ancient historians have hailed as an effort to create a single ruling class of Macedonians and Persians, even if that's historically accurate, doesn't even come close to what the Romans did. The Greeks, in contrast to the Romans, never even thought of themselves as Greeks, except A, under pressure, or B, when they were defining themselves in contradistinction to other peoples. They were Athenians, Spartans, Corinthians, and so forth, first, and Greeks, second. And they were infinitely charier about handing out citizenship than the Romans were. To conclude, both the Greeks and the Romans adopted a highly stratified view of human society, denying full human status to those at the bottom of the social ladder. And for all their achievements culturally, we are justified in questioning whether they would have achieved a tenth as much as they did had they A, not oppressed a very sizable proportion of the population, and B, not permitted an equally sizable proportion of the population to flounder. I'm thinking of all those free individuals who simply outlived their usefulness or became disabled. And what might they have achieved had they liberated and enfranchised women? Less than human indeed, though, as I mentioned at the beginning of this lecture, there was nothing unique about the Greeks and the Romans in their deplorable attitude to these others. It doesn't excuse them, but it is important to put them in a broader context. It just so happens that the Greeks and the Romans have left us more literary evidence of their callous disregard of human life and of human identity than any other people. And yet it is a fact that this was a mindset shared by all Mediterranean peoples in the ancient world. In the next lecture, we're going to see how one of these prejudices, the prejudice against foreigners, played out when the Greeks and the Romans first came into contact with one another.